Welcome to the Cycling Podcast, proudly brought to you by Shox Bone Conduction Headphones. This is Lionel here, and for the past few weeks I've been using Shox headphones, the Open Run Pro 2 model to be precise, and I've been really impressed with the comfort and sound quality. They're very different to any headphones I've used before because nothing actually goes into your ear, and straight away I found this to be much more comfortable to wear, especially when exercising. When I've used conventional in-ear headphones on the turbo trainer or out running or riding on the trails, I find that they can get sweaty and slippery and sometimes fall out of the ear. In-ear headphones can also compromise your awareness of the sounds going on around you. Shox, on the other hand, give you great sound whether you're listening to music or your favourite podcast, such as the Cycling Podcast, but they don't block out what's going on around you. So how do they work? Well, Shox bone conduction technology means that they sit just behind the ear with the sound passing to the inner ear through the skull. It sounds a bit science fiction, doesn't it? And I was a little sceptical to start with, but it really works. There's a band that holds them securely in place, and then a little speaker that takes care of the bass, which gives you richness and depth of sound that you really want, especially when listening to music. Through that combination of bone conduction and air conduction, you get unmatched sound quality, even though there's nothing actually in your ear, which, as I say, feels a lot more comfortable to wear. Crucially, though, you can still hear a lot of what's going on around you, and yet somehow it doesn't compromise your enjoyment of what you're listening to. You feel connected with your environment and surroundings while still enjoying the podcast or music that you've chosen. There's even a model that works underwater, so if you're a swimmer, check out the Open Swim Pro. There's actually 30% off the Open Swim Pro model right now, meaning they're £135 instead of £169. And Cycling Podcast listeners can get £10 off any purchase with the discount code CYCLING10 at uk.shox.com. That's uk.shox.com. We'll put all the details in the show notes. Shox, redefining the sound of sports. Now it's over to Daniel for this week's show.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and thank you, Lionel. I am joining you today on the 20th of November 2024. That is 120 years from the day when Henri Desgrange, editor of the flagging Le Tour newspaper, held a brainstorming session in a brasserie in Montmartre in Paris, and a junior reporter named Géo Lefebvre suggested the newspaper try organising a bicycle race called the Tour de France. My name is Daniel Freiber. And today, in the latest of our year review episodes, I will be pondering the legacies not of Géo Lefebvre, not of Henri Desgrange, but of some of the male riders who ended their professional careers in 2024. I will do that in the company of one gentleman who 12 months ago was in precisely that position, i.e. about to leave the peloton behind. His name is Joe Dombrowski. And we will also be joined by a rider who is very much still in gainful employment as a pro racer, and will remain so in 2024. That is, of course, the Motown maestro Larry Warbass, currently still of Decathlon Âgé d'Auxerre La Mondiale, but soon to be on the books at Tudor Pro Cycling. Larry and Joe will join me in just a couple of minutes, but before they do, I'll bring you up to speed with a couple of things that have been happening in the world of pro cycling over the last few days. I said this was an episode about retirements. Well, we learned of one last week at the Ruler Live event in London. That was where Lizzie Deignan announced that 2025 will be her last year in the professional peloton. The Yorkshire woman, of course, won the World Championship road race in Richmond in 2015 and boasts a career slam of monuments, i.e. the Tour of Flanders, Liège-Bastogne-Liège and Paris-Roubaix. Another Yorkshire native whose appearance at the Ruler event made headlines was Tom Pidcock. A lot of us wondered whether his scheduled speaking event with Matt Stevens would even go ahead, given the permafrost that seems to have descended after Pidcock was deselected from Ineos Grenadiers' Tour of Lombardy team in October, and speculation about a possible transfer to Q36.5. But take the stage, Pidcock did, and answer questions about his, in inverted commas, difficult year. He also did, with members of Ineos' senior management sitting in the audience. Asked whether he was in a happier place in terms of clarity and purpose, this is how it was reported in Daniel Benson's blog, Pidcock replied with a flat no. perhaps with the intention of getting a laugh, which it did, or perhaps because, as he put it, I'm never going to lie. He did also say that based on what he'd seen at the team's recent get-together in Manchester, some things are changing for the better, perhaps an allusion to recent staff exits. Having also told Stevens he didn't enjoy the Tour de France in 2023 or 2024, Pidcock did not reveal whether he intends to ride the race in 2025 or with what ambitions. The cycling podcast was also well represented at Roulin Live by Lionel, young Richard Abraham, but also the newly crowned Broadcast Sport Awards commentator of the year, Rob Hatch. Rob had picked up the gong the previous night. Needless to say, we're all extremely proud of him. I think it's been well documented on the podcast. I've known Rob for a long time. I know how exceptionally hard he's worked and how dedicated he's been, not over the past year, but pretty much his whole life to the craft that's now his job. Just on that, if anyone is interested in that art, that discipline, and in Rob's case, I'd also say immense talent. He and I did discuss it at some length in the Kilometre Zero live event we did in October, the recording of which is available to friends of the Cycling Podcast. Becoming a friend of the podcast gives you access to our Kilometre Zero episodes. There have been 17 new episodes this year, and there are 300 in the back catalogue. It's an annual subscription, but there is a monthly option if you want to see what it's all about. We want to ensure all our regular coverage remains free for all, so by supporting us as a friend of the podcast, you are helping us greatly in enabling us to do precisely that, keep everything free. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up. You'll receive an email with simple step-by-step instructions for how to add the feed to your favorite podcast player. It's really easy. On subscribing, you can be connected and listening in a matter of minutes. Just in the last few days, our friends of the podcast feed platform has grown, expanded to include something we are calling the Cannibal and the Badger, a virtual pub which looks and feels and will hopefully work something like an old-fashioned internet forum, newfangled but now suddenly out of favour social media platform. Yes, and that has very recently premiered and is just getting up and running, I believe. So that's another added benefit of becoming a friend of the Cycling Podcast.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here again to tell you that this episode is also supported by AG1. I've really made AG1 a part of my morning routine over the past few months. It's the first thing I have in the morning. I mix a scoop of AG1 powder with plenty of water, give it a good shake until it's well blended into a nice drink. And that is the way that I start my day. And I certainly feel like it's evened out my energy levels over the course of the day. And although I hesitate slightly to say this because I don't like to tempt fate, so far I haven't succumbed to any of those autumnal bugs that tend to fly around at this time of year. And I do wonder whether AG1's recipe of vitamins, minerals and other good ingredients to boost and top up my immune system are playing a part in that. Either way, AG1 is a blend of 70 vitamins, minerals and other good ingredients, including gut-friendly bacteria, all contained in one scoop of powder that you take once a day. It's very simple, a very easy way to give your health and immune system and your energy levels a bit of a boost. If you want to give it a go, if you want to support your health now and in the long run, start with AG1. Subscribe now and get a free bottle of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription. Those travel packs are great if you're jetting off anywhere, perhaps going on a winter training camp. You can take your AG1 with you. Go to drinkag1.com/cycling to check it out.
So, disembarking the virtual, fictitious, low-emission, no-emission private jet in Nice Côte d'Azur Airport now. First stop is somewhere halfway up the Col d'Ez, the lair, the manor of the Motown Maestro, Lucky Larry Warbass, fresh back from his holiday. Larry, where were you on holiday?
I started out in Singapore, did like 4 days there, and then bopped around Thailand a bit. So yeah, spent a total of like 3 weeks. I actually was in Montreal the weekend before that as well. So yeah, a lot of travel.
And we've already established in our green room pre-recording discussion, Larry, that you weren't invited. You went on the ASO ticket for the Saitama crit and the Singapore crit.
No, missed out on that one. Actually, apparently there's some sort of like political drama with our team and the organizers, which prevented us from doing that event for the last couple of years. But we'll see. So,
seem to be former team, of course. Larry, give us a couple of highlights quickly before we introduce our other guest. A couple of highlights of the holiday, the trip.
I have to say, we really enjoyed Singapore. Didn't really know that much about it, but it was a really cool city. I don't know, super nice, really clean, amazing food, and it was a pleasant surprise. So I didn't really know what to expect, you know, not like cities are cool, but I like also just exploring on vacation. And yeah, we really enjoyed it. It's just like had a lot of cool hip restaurants, cafes, bars, and so that was really cool. And then I would say we saw some cool temples and stuff in Thailand. That was really enjoyable. And we
hiked up some steps, didn't you?
Yeah, we did this one temple that like we didn't, or I don't know, maybe my girlfriend did, but like we didn't really know that much about it. We just knew that there was like a thing at the top. It was called like this Tiger Temple outside of Krabi in Thailand. And we show up and it was something like 1,230 something steps. And literally like the biggest steps you've ever seen, like they are way higher than they are like long, you know? And so like each one, it's like it's a single leg squat, you know? And I can't remember. It was something like, I don't know if it was 300 or 400 meters in like, at like gain in something. Anyway, it was like 45%, you know, like it worked out to like, yeah. And like, maybe say it was 400 meters gain in 800 meters or something like that. Something crazy, you know? And then we actually regretted not starting Strava at the bottom because we're like, maybe we could have. We were just crushing everyone. You know, I was running and then my girlfriend kind of cracked halfway up. So she was walking and then I'd have to wait for her. But literally, like, we got up and we spent probably like 45 minutes at the top. And when we started to go down, there were still people that we passed like on the stairs, which was just insane, you know. And then the other funny, I don't know why, but this to me was so funny, is like the amount of people that were dead, no joke, seriously, like 10 stairs from the top was insane. There were so many people just collapsed like 10, 20 stairs from the top, literally like 20 seconds from the top, and they just couldn't go up the last few stairs. And my girlfriend had brought like candy with us. And so she was just offering Haribo to everyone like who was dying on the side of the stairs, which was pretty funny. So anyway, that was a highlight. Sorry, that was a long story, but
that might be, unfortunately, Larry, as close as you'll ever get to knowing what it's like to be Tadej Pogacar. I hope not. Let's introduce our second guest today, who is an expert on the subject matter, should be an expert, has first-hand experience of the subject at hand today. It is, of course, Joe Dombrowski. Joe, who retired not a year ago, but you had raced your last race this time last year. Of course, we did a kilometer zero about your retirement, how to become an ex-pro cyclist, just a few months ago. Joe, how's it going?
It's good. We're here in Nice, where I've for the most part stayed put this year. Yeah, it's been, you know, I mean.
I thought you'd be making moonshine back in Virginia by now. No.
I make it back occasionally, but I think it's just been a really interesting year because it's obviously something totally different than what the last, realistically, 15 years of my life has looked like. In some ways, not a huge departure. I mean, I still ride my bike a lot and, still been here in Nice. But in other ways, it's a big change. But it's good.
Well, Joe, we're going to talk about retirements. We're going to talk about farewells, the riders who have bade farewell to the professional peloton at the end of this year. Some of them intentionally, some of them by design, some of them have been sort of forced out, I suppose you could say, not been able to find a contract. Of course, that's always the case at the end of every year. Some guys who have planned their retirement, others who have not. But Joe, I said to you that we were going to start the show today by asking you, putting you on the spot and asking you at this point, from this vantage point, a year later, what are three things you would tell those who are about to retire about the process of retiring as a professional cyclist?
Mm.
Give us three things. Can be advice, can just be observations.
I would say one observation is, and this probably varies rider to rider, but I suspect all cyclists are somewhat similar in that there's a certain level of like rigidity to your day-to-day. You know, as a pro, it's kind of a selfish existence. I mean, everything is about your performance and your training and your nutrition and, you know, how you feel. And I find that you say no to a lot of things. At least that was the case for me. And I think that probably most professional riders are the same. Depending on what you get into, there can be like a certain lack of purpose maybe initially. If you know that you want to do something within the sport and you know what that is, you can pretty quickly transition to that. I mean, one of the guys I wanted to speak about this evening, Cesare Benedetti, I saw that he's going to be a director in Bora, and already at the end of the season, he was kind of in a sort of intern role doing that. And I think if you're in that position and that's what you want to do, you very quickly pivot. And I guess my advice there is, like, I feel like right now I'm kind of in this information gathering phase where you talk to a lot of different people doing different things and ask questions and be curious. And I guess if I were to offer some advice, I would say if you can leverage, you know, relationships where, you know, people know you as a cyclist and maybe they're doing something that you're interested in and you can ask them about it, or maybe follow along to some degree to learn, that is potentially really valuable.
Joe, well, that will hopefully guide, maybe, if not guide our conversation, then maybe guide what some of the soon-to-be ex-cyclists who listen to us might take out of this episode. But how we're going to proceed, or I set you guys some homework. I sent you chaps two comprehensive lists of the riders who are retiring this year, World Tour and Pro Continental. Every year there are big names who retire in professional cycling. It didn't strike me, this is not maybe the sort of heftiest list of retiring riders in terms of sort of palmarès. There are some real sort of big fishes there, but maybe that in the past there have been seasons when there's been a bigger group of sort of era-defining riders who have retired. But there are a fair few. I believe the number is 21 retiring riders from the World Tour, and it's around about the same number, 25 from Pro Conti. And chaps, I ask you to sort of zero in on a couple of, on three or four riders who you particularly like to talk about, and maybe you have stories about, experiences with. Larry, the first name on your list, or the first name we're going to go to, is Thomas de Gendt, Belgian rider. I'm going to just give a couple of biographical details about some of these riders as we go. Thomas de Gendt, of course, won two Giro stages, two Tour stages, one Vuelta stage. So he completed a sort of clean sweep Grand Slam of Grand Tour stage wins. He was third in the Giro d'Italia in 2012. That was his sort of first big, big result. He came within 1 minute and 39 seconds of winning that Giro. Chaps, he has 17 wins in total. None of them were in one-day races, which is quite surprising, quite remarkable. Larry, why did you pick Thomas de Gendt?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I picked him because he was a rider that I enjoyed watching and I found interesting to race with as well. Like, yeah, I always had a few chats with him. You know, I thought he was kind of an interesting guy. I remember when we were, under 23s, and he was third in that Giro, and I remember the reason he said he was able to become a GC rider was because he stopped eating sausages or something like that, you know? And I just remember thinking that was really funny. And anyway, it was kind of funny that he never ended up, you know, going for GC really much after that. And, you know, I don't know, this guy was just kind of like a mythical character. Like, I remember we had this soigneur when I was on Aqua Blue that he always worked with De Gendt when, I think when he was on Vacan Soleil, and he said, you know, the guy, yeah, I don't know if he didn't like massage or something.
He didn't do massages in Grand Tours, no.
And then he wouldn't like warm up for the TT. And I just remember this story of like, it was like they were on the bus, I think it was in this Giro, and like they're like, aren't you going to warm up for the time trial? And he goes, touch my leg, touch my leg. And they touch his leg, they go, he goes, it's warm, isn't it? And that was his reasoning, like, don't need to do a warm up. So anyway, I thought that was kind of funny. And then, yeah, I thought it was cool how he sort of like evolved into this breakaway rider, because I guess one of my first experiences racing against him, I remember in Tour of Poland in maybe 2014 or something, I think he was on Omega Pharmalotto or whatever it was at the time. And I just remember this guy, he had to pull like the breakaway back. He had to ride the front. And I think he was kind of pissed that he had to ride the front. So he pulled this breakaway back within like, you know, 30 minutes. You know, like we were just going full gas on, and he was just riding alone. And like, you know, his teammates got pissed because, you know, he ended up pulling the brake back with like 80 Ks to go or, you know, something crazy. And I just remember being able to be like, what's this guy doing? And oh, it's like De Gendt, he's doing whatever he wants, you know? And so anyway, I just remember that was probably the first time racing with him. And then later, I don't know, maybe it was when he switched to Lotto or what, he became this crazy breakaway specialist. And it was like any time he got in the breakaway, he won almost, you know? And I found that super impressive. And then, yeah, I think, you know, in the last few years, I think while he still won a couple times, which was really cool, I think he found it a lot more difficult, you know, integrating into like the new cycling. And yeah.
I think he was a real victim. Well, he talked a lot about this, and including in his last race at the Vuelta, we talked to him a couple of times about this. He was a real victim of the way the sort of first hour of stages in Grand Tours had changed. You know, he used to say the way he did say that he would once just, you know, ride at 500 watts for I don't know how many minutes, and he would go off down the road, and you know, the first hour was so much more explosive now that was no longer possible.
Yeah, I do remember this happening many a time where he would just get on the front and then just go as hard as he could, and everyone's like, what are you doing? You know, I mean, as in, because maybe in the past that worked, but that doesn't really work anymore, you know. So yeah, but I just sort of liked his racing style, and that, yeah, he was always going for it, and like, yeah, really impressive rider, and yeah, insanely strong. And I think it's cool when, yeah, you can target so many stages, and being able to pull it off is yeah, that's cool.
Is he stopping? Because I remember him saying something about like maybe racing in Japan.
Doing what?
Like
Heron?
No, joining a Japanese team for a year.
I don't think so. You're not thinking of Ryan Taramae, are you?
I know that
Taramae is.
He is, but yeah. There was an interview a year or two ago in Cycling News, and I remember De Gendt said that, this is another thing I guess I didn't say earlier, is like a big change is going from, you know, training a lot of hours per week to not training at all or training as much as you want. And he sort of said he didn't think it was necessarily even healthy to just stop. And he had thought about the idea of racing on a team in Japan for a year, just kind of for fun.
Not sure about that. For some of the riders we're going to talk about today, I do have news of their future plans. I must admit, I don't have that info for Thomas De Gendt. And of course, you're a big star in Japan, Joe. You cracked Japan long ago, didn't you? Didn't you have an action figure, a Joe Dombrowski action figure?
I have a few. If you could see the other side of my MacBook, I've got a few stickers on there from Japan.
De Gendt, chaps, a lot of people, that result in the 2012 Giro was a bit of an outlier, and it was this, as I said, it was a breakthrough. We didn't know him that well before that, and it was early in his career, and as I say, came pretty close to winning that Giro. But if I had to pick one memory of De Gent, it was a memory that didn't for most people is not lodged in their memory for him, but what two other riders were doing. It was that last hour of the stage to Saint-Étienne in the 2019 Tour de France, which was just one of those days, sort of in my kind of time covering the Tour de France, one of the sort of most kind of electric feeling hours of racing that I've witnessed in the Tour de France, because it was the two big French stars, Alaphilippe and Thibaut Pinot, at the front of the race, sort of tearing the race apart. And almost as the kilometers, as the minutes went by, this idea was sort of implanting itself in the French kind of collective psyche that maybe Pinot was going to, who knows, win this Tour de France. And it was just a really sort of exciting, pulsating hour of racing. But of course, De Gent was already down the road and he won that stage, which I guess a lot of people might have forgotten. Joe, your first name, please.
So my first pick was Domenico Pozzovivo, which, before we get into Pozzovivo, are we sure that he's retiring?
I don't know. I mean, I was trying to think of there must be some kind of pagan tradition, something, some kind of ghost that comes back every March, or I don't know.
Could happen.
But, yeah, it's happened a couple of times now, hasn't it, that he's looked to be on the brink of oblivion, retirement, and someone has needed, I thought this was going to happen to you last year, Joe, someone has desperately needed a climber on the eve of the Giro d'Italia, and they've reached out to Pozzovivo and brought him back from the dead, but apparently not this time.
Well, I picked him because I thought it was interesting. I mean, he's a Giro man. He's done 18 Giri. I also think it's always interesting, like the last few years, how he's kind of been left out in the cold, and it becomes, I guess, like, without knowing all the details, like what, you know, conversations are happening. I think it's not easy to wait until March to sign for a team. And I would guess if you sign for a team in March, it's not exactly a rich contract. So to me, it's like the guy clearly loves what he does and wants to carry on doing it, which I can respect. You know, it's like, that's cool. I also just thought, I made a couple notes from Wikipedia last night.
Wow.
He has an econ degree and his thesis was Southern politics from unity of Italy up to the present day. And he said that post career, he thinks he may be interested to go into politics.
Yeah, he's an interesting chap. He's an avid amateur meteorologist. He's fanatically interested in weather.
He plays the piano.
Plays the piano as well. He also is a regular fixture on something called Squalo TV. Do you know what that is, guys?
I watched a bit of it last night.
Vincenzo Nibali has a Twitch show features Pozzovivo. Yeah, which features Pozzovivo. It generally features, you know, there's a crew of riders who have lived in and around Lugano for a number of years, and they're the ones who tend to congregate. Bettio is another one who's on it regularly. Ulisi as well. I can't tell you whether it's any good. I know that he and so Riccardo Ricco, the Cobra, he also does Instagram lives, and there is currently a bit of a public sort of spat between the Cobra and the panelists on Squalo TV, Nibali's Twitch channel. They've been sort of exchanging broadsides in a really sort of dark and dingy remote corner of the internet over the last couple of weeks. But whether that's what Pozzovivo intends to do with his future, I don't know. I mean, when I was looking at Pozzovivo's record, reminding myself, it shocked me, it still shocks me, how long he spent at the team, now known as, well, has been known as Bardiani, in one of its more recent incarnations. I think he spent 9 years there. From 2005 to 2013, He was at Bandiani, which is a Pro Conti team. And the first, well, the team that gave him his breakthrough in the World Tour was actually your current team, soon to be former team, Larry, AG2R.
Okay.
Yeah.
I did hear some stories about him. Like, he used to travel with like two suitcases to the races. One was like full of food. Like, he would eat like, I don't know, some ungodly amount of ricotta every night.
I think
or something.
He still does that.
He'd bring his own ricotta to the races. And anyway. Sounds like an interesting dude.
Yeah, that could be problematic. Pozzo Vivo, yeah. So six Giro top tens, one Giro stage win. By the end of his career, he kind of looked like a sort of origami aeroplane, didn't he? The way he was so sort of crooked on the bike. But, you know, I think that kind of gave him even more visibility. You couldn't really miss him in races, and it sort of deepened people's admiration for what he was doing, particularly at that age, because he continued to be pretty competitive. Chaps, on the list of retiring riders, just because we're talking about climbers, Sebastian Reichenbach, who, Larry, you're kind of replacing at Tudor.
Am I? I would say we're very different type of people, characters.
Oh, okay.
No, I just mean, like, I was teammates with him, actually. I am for 2 years.
So he was at Tudor, sort of a veteran climber, kind of, well known for, he was a Swiss national champion 1 year, 2019, I think. Very gentle, sort of introverted, quiet guy from Martigny in Switzerland. I think he was denied the opportunity to ride a home World Championships by COVID. Were the World Championships not supposed to happen in Martigny in 2020, sure, which was a shame. But sort of infamous as well, Reichenbach. Can you remember the 2018 Giro d'Italia when he was sort of shamed lightheartedly, good-naturedly by Tom Dumoulin because of the descent on the stage of the Colle delle Finestre? Dumoulin was with Reichenbach, and Dumoulin made some comment to the effect that Reichenbach had been descending like a granny, and consequently Chris Froome had been able to gain more time, and this ultimately, Dumoulin sort of suggested, cost him the Giro d'Italia. Reichenbach, he was due to finish his career at the Tour of Lombardy, but crashed at a race just before that, so he was denied that opportunity, which made me wonder whether any cycling media outlet had talked about Reichenbach's falls. Do you know the reference, guys?
No.
Reichenbach falls. So, Sherlock Holmes. Reichenbach falls were where Sherlock Holmes pushed Professor Moriarty to his downfall. It's near Grindelwald, just under the north face of the Eiger in Switzerland. Anyway, Sebastian Reichenbach, a long-term loyal servant to Thibaut Pinot, and a fine gentleman as well. Chaps, we'll have a couple more before we conclude this part. Larry, who's next on your list?
But before we move off Reichenbach, I have to say was really impressive when I was teammates with him was, this was sort of like at the height of the low carb phase and stuff.
Were you his teammate for
2 years with him. And this guy didn't eat like a single carbohydrate outside of racing. So he would literally eat, like, we had this like cocoa snoofs. It's like coconut butter at the race, whatever. And he would just literally eat like half a jar of this stuff a day, you know, essentially coconut oil, but with a little bit of the meat of the coconut. And, he wouldn't eat any carbs. He wouldn't eat any pasta, rice, anything. And somehow this guy was still like a high-performing athlete, which is just insane to me to think about. I think he'd have carbs on the bike, but that was it. And to me, that still sticks in my head that that's the most insane feat, that he was able to be a semi-decent professional while not consuming carbohydrates. Obviously, I'm sure once he started to consume carbohydrates, he was a lot better. But anyway, interesting.
Sebastian, what are you most looking forward to about retirement? Bread.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sorry.
Larry, who's next on your list?
Should we go with Luis Angel Mate?
Mm.
Yes, the Lynx of Marbella, whose retirement we whose retirement we have covered extensively on the cycling podcast, especially at the Giro d'Italia. We did a special in which Luis Angel talked about his impending retirement. Sorry, did I say the... Sorry. The Vuelta, where he talked about his impending retirement, and that was called... That episode is called The Lynx's Last Dance, I believe. Larry, why have you picked Luis?
So I thought, you know, he was like an interesting character, a really nice guy. I always really enjoyed speaking with him. And I thought it was cool, you know, he rode for Cofidis for such a long time. Somehow, like, this Spanish guy in this French team. Thought that was super interesting. And then... Yeah, I guess the reason I picked him was because I remember, I think it was in 2016, I once went to Sierra Nevada alone. And thanks to Luis, I just remember he invited me to ride with like him and the other Spanish guys like every single day. And he sort of like took me into their like group, you know, and, you know, so I ended up eating dinner with them. And so, you know, as like a, if you go to altitude like alone, it's pretty lonely, you know, but he really made me feel like welcome. And it was cool because like, yeah, then, yeah, he brought me out training with them. You know, I sat with them at dinner and it was kind of nice because like, he really welcomed me, even though, yeah, I was just like alone. And he spent like a ton of time on top of Sierra Nevada. You know, like, I mean, the guy, I would say he almost lived there half the year. And, you know, he knew every single person in the center by name, and you know, like he's a really kind, open, social guy, and I found that super cool. So yeah, I really enjoyed, you know, after that we always talked in the races, things like that, and yeah, it was, yeah, so I've always been a fan of Luis Angel Mate after that camp, and you know, I just think he's an all-around good guy, and it was nice that he had such a long career in the sport, as you know, I think, you know, a domestique and you know, not necessarily the biggest winner or anything, but he was still able to have like a long, good career. So, you know, I think that's cool.
Larry, last week in the podcast, we talked, or I talked about how it had been a bad year for domestiques in the sense that I noticed these two sort of parallel trends in teams. So slightly under the top tier in the World Tour of recruiting two types of rider in place of, well, where they used to recruit domestiques, one, very young riders, and two, riders who they think can hoard points. And I thought this contributing, in particularly in the sort of bottom half of the World Tour, to the sort of erosion of the where domestiques used to sit in those teams. What do you think?
I mean, I think that's super true. Yeah, I think like it's just getting harder and harder. I mean, if you don't have points, it's really, really hard to get a team pretty much, you know? And I think we will start to see that maybe go the other way. I guess, you know, the thing is teams think, well, like, I'd rather just sign a cheap young guy who might do something incredible. And in the end, if he doesn't, it was cheap anyway, so it's not a whole lot lost. Or, yeah, a guy who can get, like, a solid amount of points because obviously the points are so important now. And, you know, I think the thing is, eventually, I'd say in a few more years, I think it'll start to center itself out again. And teams realizing that, like, yeah, experience is important and having a well-rounded roster with, yeah, good helpers. Because, yeah, I would say, like, some winners, like, some riders can win alone. And maybe it depends on the type of race. But, yeah, I think... yeah, a good domestique or an experienced guy to help them is really important. So yeah.
Did your points, Larry, come into the equation at all in terms of your deal with Tudor next year?
No, I don't think so. I don't have like a whole ton of points. You know, I was maybe like the 20th point scorer on Decathlon or something, maybe. Okay. So no. My points, I have no idea, but I would assume not because I don't have a whole ton of points, you know? Like, yeah, my points would count on their team, but like...
yeah, but then that wasn't...
making shift in the...
And if you hadn't...
Needle.
I mean, you had that good result, didn't you, at Poitou-Charentes?
Yeah, but that's not a whole ton of points because it's 2.1. So, yeah.
Okay.
Another thing I was going to say, I'm not sure about is like, I would say that like in the bottom half of the World Tour, it's very kind of... points hungry because they don't necessarily have the big leaders that get like really a lot of points to then build guys that get less points around them. But, and I would say that there's more room for that at the top end of the world tour. But then even then, it's kind of like, I feel that then like financially, there's so much concentration at the top of the world tour in terms of budget that like, actually they just end up buying guys who get a lot of points anyway and pay them to basically be a domestique, but at like a very kind of luxury salary. So yeah, that's kind of, I mean, that's a whole other discussion is like, is the point system good or does it kind of, you know, hurt the sport? I mean, yeah, that's a whole other topic, but it definitely seems to have squeezed some guys.
Joe, who's your next departing rider?
So my next one is it Cesar or Cesare? I don't really know.
Cesare.
Cesare. Benedetti.
Although he's now Polish, so
he's now Polish.
Maybe we should pronounce it with a Polish accent.
Caesar.
Yeah. Which I noted because I was hoping to actually get a Polish passport, and it seems like the birth age of my great grandfather by a few years, I am out of.
You'd be out. I've explored that as well, Joe.
Yeah.
I think I do qualify, but I got an Irish one instead. But yeah.
Well, maybe I can make a plea to Benedetti to speak to someone.
Put in a good word.
So why have you picked Cesare?
So I picked him because I specifically remember in the 2022 Tour de France, I was roommates with Fabio Fellini. And I actually got on pretty well with him. He's kind of a funny guy. And
Gianni Savio's son-in-law.
Yes. Also an interesting fact. And we were talking about like the sort of quintessential domestique. Benedetti's name came up in that discussion. And he was like, and then I thought about it and it's like, you always saw this guy riding on the front. Especially I would say in the sort of Sagan era of Bora. And that's like the only place you'd see him is at the front or maybe making his way back up to the front with bottles. And I only spoke to him a few times, but I just, you know, it's probably a little bit of like snap judgments, but in cycling, you kind of get a vibe off of everybody and, you know, you have a guys you like, and then a bit of a shit list. And he, always seemed really friendly. You know, he'd always kind of leave space in the bunch. You know, always smiling, and he had this kind of quintessential domestique role. Maybe something that is disappearing, as we were talking about earlier, in the kind of hunt for points. I looked, so last night, he spent from 2010 until this year in the same team structure. As a kind of the role that he has, which is also really rare. I mean, like the only kind of riders that I can think of like that are, for example, like Valverde in the sort of, you know, a Barca Sports Movistar structure through its various iterations. But Valverde is Valverde, and he was very much like the leader of that team. But I think it also says something about Benedetti that when you're not a star, you have to be pretty likable and pretty dependable to stay in a team for so long like that. So I don't know. He was a guy that as a rider, even though I didn't really know him that well, I always liked him. I thought it was really cool in 2019. He won a stage in the Giro from breakaway. And, I think something that is maybe separates cycling from other sports and makes it what I think is maybe the most beautiful sport in the world is there's certainly a hierarchy within the sport, but it's kind of like everyone has their chance, you know, to have their day. And I remember, him winning that stage. And it just stuck in my mind because, you know, you always thought like, that's that guy that's always pulling on the front, you know, always working for somebody else. And I just thought it was really cool that he kind of finally had his moment in the sun.
What a gangster baller move as well, to win one race in your career and for it to be a Giro d'Italia stage.
Pretty cool.
Which was the case. Yeah.
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 The Cycling Podcast is supported by MAP.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Right, chaps, my turn. Next rider up is a little known sprinter from the United Kingdom. His name has been Mark Cavendish. I don't think he really needs any further introduction, does he? We may yet do a whole episode in this season review series about Mark Cavendish bowing out, but we've talked so much about him over the years, including even recently we did our special class of 04, which talked about the sort of genesis of Mark Cavendish and his generation at the British Cycling Academy. But I did think it would be remiss not to mention him here, also because you chaps have some experience with Mark Cavendish. Larry, I think I told you recently, your name came up in conversation with Mark recently, and he said, Larry, yeah, have you been to his house? It's dead nice, isn't it, what he's done there? It's dead nice. But yes, I didn't think I would mention Cavendish. As I said, I'm not going to go through his whole palmarès, but if nothing else, chaps, it was an excuse, because I was reminded of this by a listener, and I can't remember the name of the listener, and I can't remember where I was reminded of this. It might have been a tweet or some kind of message on social media about an interview that we ran with Mark Cavendish in 2019. Early 2019, when he was at a very low ebb. And in fact, today we're talking about retirements and Mark Cavendish retiring at the end of 2024. Well, it looked in 2019 as though he was pretty close to the exit door. So I'm going to take us back February or March 2019. I was in Mallorca. I met up with Mark and we asked him how things were going and was he any closer to rediscovering his best form and recovering from the Epstein-Barr virus that had sort of blighted his previous couple of years. Now, long-time listeners this exchange will ring a few bells. I think they will remember this, but let's just hear a little bit of that, shall we?
Listen, I might not be right. And if I'm not, then, yeah, it is, unfortunately. Like, I can never be the same again, you know, but I just have to try and see what I can do, you know. Like, that's what I mean. Like, I know if I put the work in, I'm the best. No matter what people think, if you're being ill or not, like, if I'm healthy and I put the work in, I'm better than anybody else. Like, I don't see how you...
Still think that?
I don't see how you can dispute it. I don't see how you can dispute it. Tell me when I've ever put the work in and not being ill and not being better than everybody else. Tell me, Daniel. Go on.
Well, as a counterpoint to that, you've always said, I remember back when you were 23, 24, you've always predicted that you would lose speed, maybe earlier than some sprinters because of the way you sprint and because you relied a lot on leg speed. So, you know, that might be one factor that people are considering when they imagine that you could have lost it, you could have fallen off a cliff.
I did all that in 2016 and then got ill in 2017. Do you just lose it like that overnight? I don't think you just lose it overnight, do you? Do you? I don't know.
We'll see.
Your trainer? tell me, go and ask someone, I don't know. I don't think you just lose it from one day to the next, you just lose it. Doesn't happen. I'm sorry. I haven't studied physiology at uni, but
You cannot just lose it from one day to the next. It's not possible.
So, chaps, that was Mark telling me in no uncertain terms in 2019 that he was still the best. He was still going to prove he was the best. You can probably tell from that clip that I was pretty skeptical. And I have a few memories of that period, conversations with Mark. I can remember another one in Mallorca, and it was the same period. And I can remember being in a Carrefour supermarket, a la Marc Soler at the start of a stage of this year's Vuelta a España. And I remember I was in the cereals aisle of a Carrefour supermarket. And I can remember Mark Cavendish being on the phone and him screaming down the phone at me, "Who's better than me, Daniel? Who's better than me? Tell me now. So this was a period of defiance, shall we say. And he was right to be defiant because he proved, he made us all eat not only our golden grahams, but our words. Because in 2021, of course, he came back and won 4 stages of the Tour de France. And then this year, he conquered the Holy Grail, didn't he? That 35th Tour de France stage win. Chaps, what is there to say that hasn't already been said about Mark Cavendish? But Joe, we'll start with you. You were his teammate. You were his roommate, in fact, briefly, at Astana. Did you foresee the denouement that we did see this summer?
Yeah, I would say so. I think a lot of people were skeptical, but I don't want to speak for Larry, but we were riding a while back and we had this conversation because he had been speaking with Geraint Thomas, and G had sort of posed like a rhetorical question, like, do you feel any older? You know, like, do you feel any different? And his answer was no. No, for himself. Like, he's essentially saying, like,
oh, okay,
nothing's changed. And I think that we kind of have a bias towards age. And I think that also cycling is very, what have you done for me lately? And there is a sort of ebb and flow to things. And sometimes you have a great season and sometimes you have a less great season. But ultimately, I think unless the rider kind of loses the love and passion for it, that I think everything else changes a lot more slowly than we think. So I wouldn't say it was a surprise, especially like, what was it, 2021 when he came back and won 4 stages of the Tour? Yeah, so...
yeah, that's a long time ago. That's 3 years ago,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, but...
Joe.
I don't know.
The thing that I find extraordinary about what happened this year, what happened at the Tour de France, is that it sits as this magical, almost hermetically sealed moment in isolation from everything else that, to be honest, he produced at the Tour de France. He didn't really come close on any other day. And yet on that particular day, it looked
easy,
almost, I won't say effortless,
I think some guys rise to the occasion
as though he was going to do that every
day.
Like, yeah. Well, he always has, hasn't he? He did it in, I mean, another lesser example, but sort of similar in some respects, was the last stage of the Giro the previous year, which was going to be his last day in the Giro d'Italia. And I just felt that day it was purely the grandeur of the setting, i.e. literally in the shadow of the Colosseum, which caused him to rise to the occasion in the way that you described.
Yeah, I think
there's
an element of that. Like, I guess I can think of, I mean, speaking of Geraint Thomas, you know, just a minute ago, like, he's another guy to me that is a bit similar, where sometimes you see him in February and it's like, ooh, this far from tour winning form. But then he, whether it's like training or, you know, mental state or whatever it may be, I would say when you know, the biggest races come round, he is generally, if he stays upright, there at the forefront. So I don't really have an answer as to what that is.
But none of us have got it.
Because, like, I felt during my career, like, I always trained the same and put in the same effort, but sometimes it was like I was going great, and sometimes I couldn't peel the skin off a banana. And it's like, I don't know why that is. But then some guys are like a metronome. You know, you look at like a Valverde or a Pogacar, and maybe that's just because they're so much better. And maybe like someone like me, you have to kind of squeeze every drop out of the rag to. You know, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that, but I wouldn't. Someone of like the class of Cav, I wouldn't write off. And I think, and speaking to age, I think age is talked about too much. I think you can perform till you're 40.
Larry.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I wasn't surprised. Like, I thought he could do it, but. In my head, the way he was going to do it was the way that he did it, you know, like one and done sort of, you know, like he was going to come and then like shock everyone one day and win the stage, you know, because like what I really like about Cav is that like he is the guy that as soon as you write him off, he proves you wrong, you know, and there's like a few guys, you know, I remember when I was teammates with Taylor Finney, he was a bit like that or, you know, even I remember, I mean, maybe at the end it wasn't the same, but like Sagan, I remember... Everyone had kind of written him off. And then I remember in 2020, this stage in the Giro that he won that was just so insane. I mean, this guy was so next level, you know? And it's like, I always find it cool when there's these guys who you can't write off, you know? Because as soon as the people write them off, they prove everyone wrong. And I really like that in a rider. Like, I think that's so cool to see. And Cav is definitely one of those people, you know? It's like, as soon as everyone writes him off, boom, he like pulls something out of the hat. And that I think is really cool and respectable. But I would say maybe Cav, unlike Joe, maybe, you know, maybe Joe was able, and maybe I'm the same, like, you know, okay, focused on it all the time, whatever. You know, I think Cav struggled to be like super focused the whole year. And I think he found the way that like he can be successful is like, you know, he'd go on these training camps in Greece with his Greek coach or whatever, and then they motor pace every day. And I think like, Cav maybe needed someone there to sort of kick his ass, you know, and be like, okay, this is what you need to do to get into shape. And maybe over the other years and over the course of the years, he didn't always do that. And when it really counted, I think he did. And I think, yeah, that got him in the place where he could do what he is capable of, you know?
It's a strange mix because on the one hand, he reveled in proving people wrong, but also that doubt on the part of other people around him was kind of poison for him. He needed to be surrounded by people who really, really loved and believed in him while kicking his ass.
You know what I think may have made him good too is like a lot of things, but two things that stick out is like, I think he has a massive chip on his shoulder.
No.
And he hates when you say he can't do something. And then I think also like kind of what Larry was alluding to, I think someone like him or even like with G, sometimes I think this, like, I think some of the longevity is also that maybe not always being 110% laser focused, because there are guys that are 110% laser focused all the time and they're really good. And then at some point it's not like sustainable for them. So it is a balance.
Chaps, we should move on. Next name, who would like to go? I can't remember whose turn it is. Would anyone like to talk about Edvard Boasenhagen?
Yeah, that was going to be my third-ish guy, right? So
your current teammate, Larry.
Yeah,
should
exactly.
Should I give a few stats just to... just before you start, Larry. So... I'll just find him on my list here. So he's now 37 years of age, of course, Norwegian rider. 81 pro victories, including a Tour stage years, Gent-Wevelgem, a Giro stage. I mentioned last week that we had a cover of Pro Cycling Magazine in 2010, which asked, is Ed van Bleswenhagen the best rider since Eddie Merckx? And he had 50 wins before he turned 26. He had no wins after 2019 Dauphiné. Larry, unpick the riddle wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in a mystery that is Ed van Bleswenhagen.
Yeah, I mean, so I only had the pleasure, I think, of doing one race with him this year. That was Milan-San Remo. And yeah, I mean, I enjoyed, you know, he came to our, I don't think he signed till maybe January or something this year. So he came to our January camp, I remember, because I remember he even came a few days late because I don't think he had signed yet. So anyway, very late signing. Yeah, it was something like, you know, the team realized they were going to miss a few guys to injury and they decided to sign another rider or something like that. Or I can't exactly remember why. But anyway, they needed another guy. They decided to sign Bleswenhagen. And yeah, I mean, it was cool because what's insane to me is how much some of the younger guys didn't even realize how good of a rider he was, you know? And I remember, yeah, I mean, when I was like younger in the sport, this guy was like one of the greatest out there. And so I remember we were actually sitting at the training camp and we looked up his, before he came, we looked up his palmarès and he was something like 13th all time on Pro Cycling Stats or, you know, something. Maybe you said that, I don't know. But anyway, okay, he might even be top 10 all time in terms of his palmarès, which is just unreal. Like, you know, he's even above Tor Hushovd in terms of his like ranking all time. And this is like, you know, based on like the races that they won and everything like that. So anyway, this guy was like unreal and he could do everything. And I don't know, I thought that was really cool. You know, like for me, he was such a classy rider. You know, he could win sprints. He could get over the climbs. I think he probably won some time trials. And, you know, I don't know if maybe the reason later in his career he didn't win as much is because like he's also a very quiet and reserved guy, and he's not, I mean, he's probably the opposite of Cav a little bit, you know, in terms of like he's never going to go out and, you know, say something or even maybe stand up for himself that much. I mean, I guess he would, but like you know, I would say maybe at the beginning when he was treated as such a star, you know, for them, it was just easy to win the races. Whereas like maybe later on, I don't know, he didn't want to like take the limelight or, you know, like, I don't know if maybe yeah. If he didn't have the support, I don't know. So anyway,
I mean, Larry, what I've heard over the years, and I mean, I'm sort of always loath to impose these kind of, they're almost judgments on riders' career from, you know, a position of really not knowing at all everything that was going on. But there are people who say he wasn't a rider who liked fighting for position in the peloton, which really limited him in the classics in particular. He won that Gent-Wevelgem, but that was, you know, that was an attack on the second time up the Kemmelberg, and he's kind of rode away with one other rider. But he didn't fare well in races like Flanders. He was fifth in Roubaix once, but didn't have any other results in Roubaix. And that sort of reflects the fact that he wasn't, although, you know, he had the punch and he had some physiological characteristics that lent themselves to those races, he didn't have the desire to fight for position and get in sort of where it hurt. He also didn't crash very much, which is maybe a reflection of that as well. I don't think he really was someone who took a lot of risks. And just generally that he maybe fell into a bit of a comfort trap, you know, obviously was on big contracts initially he moved from HTC to Team Sky. And just talking to, I've spoken in the last few days to a couple of people who worked with him. If you look at where his results started to tail off and where this narrative of him being the, you know, the next huge star that sort of started to pale, it was kind of the period when things became hyper professional and you couldn't really thrive without sort of seeking out those marginal advantages, you know, whether it was altitude camps or so on and so forth, you know, moving away from your hometown, in his case Norway, somewhere with kind of fairly inclement winters. He's kind of slide I suppose, sort of coincided, I would say, with the advent of that period, the sort of hyper-professionalisation of the sport. And also, you know, he was sort of duplicated, bettered, surpassed by other riders who did all the same things but slightly better. Sagan was the best example. Sagan was sort of a Boassen-Hagen plus, wasn't he?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, no, and I mean, it's true. You know, I mean, he lived in Norway his whole career. And I remember, like, last year when he was coming to training camp, I don't think he had almost touched his bike because he'd just been skiing and stuff. And yeah, I think he did, like, the majority of his training indoors in the winter. And yeah, I mean, I guess that probably maybe worked better in the past than it would do now. So, but anyway, very pleasant guy, super nice, super down to earth. And yeah, he was a pleasure to be on the team with, even if I didn't spend that much time with him.
Let's move on. Joe, were you going to talk to us about Rigoberto Urán?
I think it's two Urans, isn't it? I don't know exactly what that means, but it means, it means something.
And yeah, he wasn't named after the pop group Duran.
No, but I mean the like whole Duran. Second name.
No, it means that his mum and his dad had the same surname.
Interesting.
We hope not.
Yeah, he was my pick because he was a teammate. I always thought he was kind of a cool guy. But I don't know, he, especially later on in his career, he seems almost larger than cycling. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen some of his following in Colombia there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, there's a lot to say on that. Yeah.
That was and he just has this kind of swagger, I guess is the best word. And, you know, there's a lot of things I like about him. I mean, I think he was one of the kind of early Colombians to come over. I want to say it was Tainax was the team. And I want to say it was like, what, 2006 or 2007? He had a bad crash early on. Might have been Tour Switzerland. I think he broke both arms or both elbows.
Yeah, it was one of those spectacular crashes where he sort of you saw him on live TV go into a ravine.
But yeah, just, you know, I think a long, consistent performer. I would say his kind of peak of his career was in the later part of the 2010s. I think 2017 he was second in the Tour. And I don't know, he's just kind of an entertainer. I think he comes from an interesting background. I believe the story was his father was actually killed when he was quite young.
He was murdered when Rigoberto was 14. He sold lottery tickets, his father, and he was killed by a paramilitary group is what the sort of investigators thought, but the actual culprit has never been found. And then Rigoberto was left as the kind of breadwinner in the family and had to take over the dad's trade of selling lottery tickets, and sort of he became the paternal figure in the family at the age of 14. So it's a real an extraordinary rags to riches story. I remember at the start of his career, I remember Johan Brunel saying that he was a future Grand Tour winner. And at that time, he looked, in fact, more like a one-day race rider at the very early in his career when he started with Caisse d'Epargne, but he developed into a Grand Tour rider. He was second in the GC, in the Giro, in both 2013 and 2014. And that looked as though, well, that looked like the prelude to a fantastic Grand Tour career when he was going to win maybe multiple Grand Tours, but it never really happened. He had that second place in the Tour in 2017, of course an Olympic silver medal.
I think he's never actually won a stage race.
Is that true? I think you.
Which is kind of crazy.
I think you're right. Yeah. He won a Tour de France stage in Chambéry on the day when Richie Porte crashed out in 2017. 14 wins in total. So stage wins in all three Grand Tours. And a rider, chaps, I would say, who's on the bike persona was completely at odds with his off the bike persona. Because, again, I don't want to diminish what he achieved, and it is extraordinary, particularly given where he came from. I don't want to diminish that at all, but he wasn't an entertaining bike rider. And I mean, I was thinking about this before we start recording today. I was going to ask you, chaps, did you ever once in your career, did it ever cross your mind when you were pros that you needed to entertain the watching public? Was that ever a consideration for you? Because, you know, I put myself in Rigoberto Urán's shoes, and I wouldn't have cared about entertaining anyone either. You know, I would have been very happy to cling on to the best riders in the world, which he did in some of the biggest races in the world, you know, like when he finished on the podium in the 2017 Tour de France. But he was not aggressive at all.
No, to be honest, I don't think there's that many riders that are good enough to be entertaining.
Yeah, you have to be pretty damn good to be entertaining.
Like, I don't think
honest.
I was ever that good.
Yeah. That's very true. It's not easy to be entertaining. Yeah. But yeah. No, I don't think that's really crossed my mind all that much.
I just think he had such an interesting story, which was, you know, my sort of affinity for him. I also remember him telling me he had a third bike with, you know, like a second home bike, so to speak, or third home bike. And he was like, oh, for my Italian family. And that was another thing I found interesting about him is because he was one of these early Colombians, you know, I think it's quite common, like, you know, Larry and I are an example of this, where, I came to Nice in at the end of 2012, at the very beginning of my pro career, and it was at the very beginning, like me, Ian Boswell, and Larry. And now there's kind of this like pretty established American cohort here, and I think that, you know, riders that speak the same language or come from the same country but are not European often kind of congregate together, just because everything you kind of figure out when you first go to Europe is very word of mouth. It's like every.
So where does the third bike come in?
Well, essentially, like he was like, oh, I have another family, and it's like my European family, and I'm going to stay with them. Yeah. And I guess there's this Italian family who he stayed in touch with and still visits that basically like kind of took him in as a young professional bike rider in his first year, when I think he didn't really have any sort of, you know, base or contacts here.
Chaps, I am going to run through some others because we have been going almost an hour, I think, and we need to put our foot on the accelerator a little bit. I'm going to, as I say, run through some of the other chaps we unfortunately won't be seeing in the Pro Peloton next year. Robert, when you're at liberty, both of you, to chip in with any stories, experiences, comments, observations on any of these. Robert Hasink, of course, is retiring. Another rider, Larry or Joe, you talked about Cheche Benedetti having ridden for Bora throughout his career. And Robert Hasink never changed teams either. He stayed at what is now Visma Lisa Bike throughout his career. Two times Giro dell'Emilia winner, Tour of California winner. Seventh in the Vuelta at age 22. I thought he was going to be a Grand Tour winner when he started his career and got that five-year contract. I remember with Rabobank was the first contract that he signed. He was tipped for very, very big things. Ended up having a brilliant career, but particularly in the second half as a domestique. Another illustrious domestique, Luke Rowe, sort of talismanic road captain for Team Sky, Ineos Grenadiers, member of five winning Tour de France teams. He was also tipped for big things, but in the classics, there was definitely a feeling at the start of his career that he was going to be a classics winner. Never really happened. In 2016, he was fifth in Tour of Flanders and fourth in Het Nieuwsblad. That was his sort of best classics campaign, but never won a big one. He did win one stage of the Tour of Britain, and he won a stage of the Herald Sun Tour. Larry, he's going to be a DS at Decathlon next year, Lucro.
Yeah, I heard he's a little bit scared because he went to the first meeting and they were only speaking French. So yeah. But no, I mean, I think he'll be a great DS. You know, I think a lot of teams probably thought the same. And yeah, Decathlon won him over. So that's cool. I think he'll be really good. And yeah, I think for the team, it's really what they need because, yeah, they want to become more international and he'll help them do that. And I think, yeah, as a DS for the classics and stuff, there's probably not many guys out there who are better.
Larry, something extraordinary happened to me in a decathlon the other day.
What happened?
I went in.
And you bought nothing?
And I bought nothing.
Yeah.
That never happened to me before. And I didn't buy anything because I was doing a trail race the next day. And part of the obligatory kit was a plastic beaker of some description, and I bought these foldable plastic beakers from Decathlon before, but they had sold out because a lot of people who were running the trail race the next day had obviously been in. But that was a first for me. Next name on the list, Dario Cataldo, Italian climber, former Baby Giro winner, won a stage of the Vuelta a Cutunegru in 2012, 18 years as a pro. Another climber, Simon Geschke, German rider, 16 years as a pro. Tour de France stage win at Pralou in 2015. He came very close to winning the Tour de France King of the Mountains title in 2022. Won a Giro d'Italia with Tom Dumoulin. Ignatas Konovalov.
Do you know what I always think of when I hear his name? Yeah, that Shaggy song, Mr. Boombastic. I always think like Anova Lobos.
Oh, yeah. Yes. 17 years as a pro. Won one stage in a Grand Tour. Can you chaps remember which
the
one it
Giro
was?
The Giro d'Italia was like that 60K TT, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When he was on Cervelo.
Yes, in Rome when Denis Menchov crashed.
Oh, okay. So it was the last. It wasn't the 60K TT.
No, it was the final stage of the 29. Okay. Yeah. Gorka Izagirre, long-time domestica, Movistar and other teams. Maybe best known for this, though.
Aurrera tatzera ikusi pausu berdinak, errepide zuzen honetan.
That was his melodic cameo on a Basque TV variety show a couple of years ago, Aukera Berriak. We'll remember that very fondly. He's also retiring, won one Giro stage in 2017 in Peskice. Lawson Craddock, you chaps probably... I used to get you mixed up with Lawson Craddock, Larry, in fact.
I used to think you were from Texas.
Yeah. Lawson Craddock, 2 times US National TT champion. Do either of you know, I must confess I don't, he seemed to have issues in 2024 just based on his results. He didn't finish many races. Did he have physical problems in 2024?
Not physical problems, I don't think, no.
No.
I think CBF problems.
CBF?
You can't be
Oh.
No, I mean, I think he just was, he was done with it.
He checked out.
Yeah, okay. He was a bit checked out. But no, I mean, huge talent. When we raced with him in the under 23s, we were both on the national team with him. And yeah, I mean, he was supposed to be one of the next big things. And I mean, he was super good. Like, I mean, really strange, but when he was like a neo pro, I think he turned pro with like Giant Shimano or whatever it was at the time. And he was like on the podium of Tour California overall, I think. You might have to look that one up again. But anyway, as a neo pro, which was like, that's huge, you know? And so, yeah, I think, super great rider. And then, yeah, in the end, I think he just got a bit tired of being, I don't know, a pro cyclist and, you know, with the family and everything, like coming back over from the US and coming to Europe. And yeah, I think he was just a bit tired of it at the end. So, and I don't think he'd mind me saying that, but yeah.
Lilian Calmejean. only 31 years old. Larry's snickering.
No, he was my teammate also.
He wanted to win a stage in all three major tours. That was his big ambition. He went to the Giro d'Italia this year trying to complete the set because he'd won in the Vuelta in 2016 and the Tour de France in 2017. He'll be doing triathlon and trail races in 2025. He says, Larry, this one took me by surprise a little bit because he is only 31 years of age. And, well, he caused a bit of a stir a few times in the last couple of years on social media. He was quite outspoken and in races as well. He was pretty animated and could be quite a sort of temperamental character.
Yeah, I would say temperamental is a good word to describe him. I mean, to be honest, I had pleasant experiences with him for the most part. You know, I think he was maybe slightly more difficult when he was on like Total or whatever it was, Direct Energies or whatever, you know, because like he was winning some big races and, you know, once he sort of came to our team, maybe he'd cooled off like a little bit. And to be honest, I had like, I enjoyed racing with him, you know.
We're almost an hour into the podcast. Most people have turned off by this point.
Sorry, so
you don't have to be diplomatic.
No. But, you know, he definitely had a reputation. To be honest, like, I don't know, I still chat with him every now and then. I think he's a funny guy, but yeah, I think at certain times he was difficult.
From an observer, journalist point of view, I kind of like the fact that there are guys like that. I always used to enjoy covering, talking to Nasser Bouhanni, because he was a little bit different. You know, he wasn't sort of genteel and you know, and amenable like the majority of you. A few lead-out men retiring. A bit of a glut of lead-out men retiring in 2024. Boy Van Poppel, brother of Danny, son of Jean-Paul. Rudy Selig, long-time lead-out man to Sagan and Sam Bennett. Mikhail Morkov, that was bad pronunciation. Mikhail Morko, of course, well, renowned as one of the best lead-out men in the world, was still leading out Mark Cavendish in the Tour de France this year, although didn't have his best day on the day when Cavendish did break the record. Three-time national champion, four-time world champion on the track, and also an Olympic champion on the track as well. He's becoming the Danish national coach. Also a lovely, lovely fella. One of the nicest, sort of most polite and considerate athletes to deal with, in my experience, I would say.
Also one of the smoothest guys on the bike. I have to say, like, to me, this guy had one of the most beautiful positions and pedal strokes on the bike. I don't know, kind of random, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Two more in that category, lead out men, Ramon Sinkeldam, about whom I've got an unbroadcastable story, but maybe I'll tell you guys after we've stopped recording. And Jacopo Guarnieri, also, like you both, former Cycling Podcast audio diarist. Jacopo is going to become an agent. He also worked with me for ITV on the Tour de France this year, on British TV, and he set quite a few hearts fluttering among some crew members in the month of July. Marc Saul, 31 years old. His last team was Groupama. He was sort of a lead-out man, kind of a fast rider as well. Paddy Bevin is also retiring, 33 years old. Kiwi, winner of the Tour of Turkey in 2022. He had some heart issues in 2023. He still had a contract with DSM for next year, but is going to retire anyway. Jason Osborne, two-time e-bike world champion. Of course, he was also a silver medalist in rowing in the 2021 Olympics, subsequently switched to road cycling. He's going to concentrate on gravel and e-bike racing in future, but had a short but quite impressive road career in the sense that, well, he was second in the Tour of Austria in 2023, not bad at all. I read an interview with him in German press the other day. He said that road cycling, he found road cycling too stressful when you weren't getting many results. Just a couple more. Kevin Le Danois of Arkea, 31 years old. He's also retiring. Nicolò Bonifazio, Italian sprinter, rode mainly in French teams, 31 years old. In 2020, won a stage of Paris-Nice. I seem to remember the next day he pulled out of that race, and I was the first to report this news because I walked into a boulangerie and was queuing for a croissant, and there he was standing in front of me buying a croissant, and this had not yet been reported on race radio. They still thought that he was in the peloton. 21 wins for him. And last couple, Alexis Vuillermoz, who one of you, was it you, Larry?
I was teammates.
You were going to tell us a little bit about.
Yeah, actually, really nice guy. I remember him being quite welcoming to me when I joined like AG2R. You know, like coming to a French team, it was like, it wasn't so easy being a foreigner joining on a French team. And I remember him just being, really like, welcoming and nice to me when I joined the team. And so that was really cool. He was a great rider, won a stage of the Tour de France. I would say a lot of talent, and maybe in the end didn't really get it all out the later years, I'd say. I don't really know why, but I don't know. Super nice guy, really strong rider, had like an insane punch, like 1 minute. And this guy could like push himself to his limit. I don't know why, but I remember in this Giro in 2019, we were going up the Motirolo, and like, I don't know, I had helped like position the guys like at the bottom. And then I remember coming up, and for some reason, like our team car was parked on the side of the road. I was like, what happened? And like, Alexi had like gone so deep. He had this like asthma attack to this point where he couldn't see, and he just rode off the road on the uphill, you know? Like, and I just remember being like, I don't know how that's possible, but I think this guy was really able to push himself beyond his limits. That like, that was an insane, that I've never seen before. But, you know, I just remember in training, even like we'd do like a 1 minute effort, and this guy would be like, I mean, he'd do an insane, you know, test, and then he'd be like dead, you know. Which I don't know. It was kind of cool to see when guys can push themselves that far. So anyway, nice guy.
Very much a puncher when that stage to Mur de Bretagne in 2015. Another puncher, French puncher, who is retiring finally at 39 years of age, is Julien Simon. I don't know if either of you guys had any dealings, experiences with him, but he was the sort of Tadej Pogacar of the French Cup. He was very good in French Cup races, wasn't he? He won that twice. I'm exaggerating slightly. But tended to excel in those domestic French one-day races. And well, chaps, that pretty much concludes our rundown on those riders who we will not be seeing unless something changes in the Pro Peloton in 2025.
Is there any major names who don't want to retire but are not with a contract?
I wouldn't say any major names at this point, Joe. I don't think so. I don't think so. Larry would have been the biggest name. Larry, just before we go, have you received a free watch yet?
I have not received my watch yet. I guess they still have to engrave it. So,
wow.
Oh, okay. But one will be forthcoming. Yeah. That's very exciting.
That's exciting.
Yes. Well, Larry, we'll no doubt be hearing from you again in the coming weeks. Hopefully. Have you got training camp coming up?
Yep. December, I think 9th through the 22nd or something in Spain. So,
excellent. Meanwhile, Joe, like me, will be continuing to revel in floating aimlessly space-time.
I did my first running race a few weeks ago.
We talked about this.
19-minute 5K.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, watch out.
Can you beat him, Daniel?
It would be quite, yeah, I could beat that, but I think if Joe, I think, I suspect that Joe hasn't really done any specific.
It was the first time I've ever run like really fast.
Well, I don't think you've still run really fast
yet. Cardio-wise, I was okay, but I just felt like any faster, it was on the promenade, and I felt any faster, just like one leg was going to like fly off into the sea.
Okay, Joe, showdown, Clash of the Titans on the Promenade des Anglais in March.
Right on. But I reckon, actually, I'd like to do one of these.
It'll be like Jake Paul versus
Mike Tyson.
I
want to do one of these vertical kilometers.
Yeah, we've also talked about that. Yes, let's deal with the 5K on the Promenade first and go from there, shall we? But chaps, it's been a delight to spend the last hour and a bit with you, and thank you very much for your company, and no doubt we'll be hearing from both of you soon.
Thanks, guys.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.